condition affected my emotions. I prayed, and others prayed with me, but a sense of despair began to set in. Is it worth all this? I asked several times every day. The doctors and nurses kept trying to push medications on me for my depression, but I refused. I'm not sure why. Perhaps because I had so much medicine in me, I didn't want any more. Besides, I didn't think more medicine would do any good. I wanted to be free from my miserable existence and die. Obviously, I felt wholly unequipped to deal with that turn of events. I now know that I was a textbook depression case. Soon everyone else knew it too. Would you like to talk to a psychiatrist? My doctor asked. No, I said. A few days later, one of the nurses asked, would you like for me to call in a therapist, someone you can talk to? My answer was the same. Because I didn't want to talk to anyone, what I called stealth shrinks began to creep into my room. I see you've been in a very severe accident, one undercover psychiatrist said after reading my chart. He tried to get me to talk about how I felt. I don't want to talk about the accident, I said. The truth is, I couldn't. How could I possibly explain to anyone what had happened to me during the 90 minutes I was gone from this earth? How could I find words to express the inexpressible? I didn't know how to explain that I had literally gone to heaven. I was sure that if I started talking that way, he'd know I was crazy. He'd think something had gone dreadfully wrong with my mind, that I had hallucinated, or that I needed stronger drugs to take away my delusions. How could I put into words that I had had the most joyful, powerful experience of my life? How could I sound rational by saying I preferred to die? I knew what was waiting, but he didn't. I had no intention of talking to a psychiatrist or anyone about what happened to me. I saw that experience as something too intimate, too intense to share. As close as Eva and I are, I couldn't even tell her at the time. Going to heaven had been too sacred, too special. I felt that talking about my 90 minutes in heaven would defile those precious moments. I never doubted or questioned whether my trip to heaven had been real. That never troubled me. Everything had been so vivid and real, I couldn't possibly deny it. No, the problem was, I didn't want to share that powerful experience with anyone. That didn't stop the psychiatrist from coming into my room and trying to help me. After a few times, they didn't tell me they were psychiatrists. It's humorous now. But the hospital psychiatrists were determined to help me. After I refused to talk to them, they would sneak into my room and observe me. Sometimes they came in while a nurse was working on me. Other times they came in and studied my chart and said nothing, and I assumed they expected me to start a conversation. Often they'd walk in and say something like, I'm Dr. Jones, but nothing else. The doctor might check my pulse and ask, how's your stomach? He'd examine my chart and ask pertinent questions. Eventually, he'd give himself away with a simple question as, how do you feel today? About the same. How do you feel about all of this? No matter how they varied the routine, they always ask how I really felt. You're a psychiatrist, aren't you? I'd ask. Well, actually, yes. Okay, what do you want to know? You want to know if I'm depressed? The answer is I'm very depressed, and I don't want to talk about it. The conversations went on, but I blotted most of them from my mind. Even though I knew Dr. Jones and the others were trying to help me, I didn't believe there was any hope. I hated being depressed, but I didn't know what to do about it. The longer I lay in bed, the more convinced I became that I had nothing to look forward to. Heaven had been perfect, so beautiful and joyful, I wanted to be released from the pain and go back. Why would anyone want to stay here after experiencing heaven? I asked God. Please, please take me back. I didn't die, and I didn't get over my depression. I didn't just refuse to talk to psychiatrists. I didn't want to talk to anyone about anything. I didn't want to see anyone. I would have been just fine if no one visited me, or so I told myself. In my depression, I just wanted to be left alone, so I could die alone, without anyone trying to resuscitate me. I also had enough pride as a professional and as a pastor that I didn't want anyone to see how bad off I was. I don't mean just the physical problems. I didn't want them to know about my low emotional state either. When people did get into the room to see me, of course, their words and gazes made me feel as if they were saying, "You're the most pitiful thing I've ever seen." I guess I was. And so the depression continued. It would be a long time before God would give me another miracle. I was the father of three children, the husband of a wonderful wife, and until the accident, a man with a great future. I was 38 years old when the accident happened, and until then, the picture of health and in great physical shape. Within days after my accident, I knew I would never be that virile, healthy man again. Now I was utterly helpless. I couldn't do anything for myself, not even lift my hand. Deep inside, I feared I would be helpless for the rest of my life. As an example of my helplessness, I had not had a bowel movement for the first 12 days in the hospital. Knowing my system would turn septic, they gave me an enema, but that didn't do much good. I say not much good because I would only pass a tiny amount, and the nurse or nursing assistant would smile with delight. One day I managed to squeeze out a tiny bit. "Oh, that's so good. We're so happy for you. Let's wait. Maybe there'll be more." In my depression, I'd think, "This is the most pitiful experience in my life. I'm like a baby. Everyone gets excited over a tiny bowel movement." I don't remember what I said to the nursing assistant, but I'm sure I wasn't pleasant. She left the room. That was one of those rare times when no one was visiting. I was totally alone and glad for the peace and quiet. Within minutes after the nurse left, the enema took effect. I exploded. I had the biggest bowel movement I've ever had in my life. The odor overwhelmed me. In my panic, I clawed the sheet, and my fingers finally found the call button. Seconds later, the young nursing assistant raced into the room. "I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do this," I said. "I'll help you clean it up." The words had no sooner left my mouth before I realized I couldn't help her. I felt terrible, helpless, and loathsome. I started to cry. No, don't worry about a thing. We're just happy that you did it. This is good because it means your system is beginning to work again." In humiliation, I could only lie there and watch the poor young woman change everything. It must have taken her at least half an hour to clean up, and then at least twice that long for the odor to vanish. My embarrassment didn't leave me, even though my mind tried to tell me differently. I had barely taken in any food for 12 days, and this was a real breakthrough. I, however, could only think of it as one of the most embarrassing events of my life. As awful as it seemed to me, more embarrassing, helpless experiences caught up with me. I had to have a urinal. I couldn't wipe myself. I couldn't shave. I couldn't even wash my hair. They had to bring special devices to lay my head in and pour water over my hair and then drain it down a tube to a garbage can. In another act of incredible kindness, Carol Benefil, who had cut my hair for years, came to trim my hair several times while I was confined to my bed. For these 60-mile round trips, Carol would accept no money whatsoever. Friends, family, and medical personnel found ways of providing for all my physical needs, but I could only think of myself as being completely, utterly helpless. My right arm, the one that hadn't been broken, had so many IVs in it that they had a piece of wood taped to me so I couldn't bend the arm. I had IVs everywhere. They ran into my chest, entered the tops of my feet. They lined up in a major tube that went directly to my heart, through my chest. Many of my veins collapsed. I was so completely incapacitated, they had to lift me off the bed with chains to change my bedding or do anything else that required moving me. I was losing weight at an alarming rate, which scared the doctors. I just couldn't eat anything, and atrophy had set in. During the nearly 4 months I stayed in the hospital, I lost about 60 pounds. Before the accident, I had weighed 210, and I got down to less than 150. The only way they could determine my weight was to put me in a sling like a baby to lift me up off the bed and weigh me. They tried to coax me into eating and tempted me by preparing my favorite foods, but nothing tasted good. Just the smell of food nauseated me. I had no appetite. I tried to eat, I really did, but I couldn't handle more than a few bites. I assume that depression stopped me from eating, although I don't know if that was the cause. I do know that when I tried, I couldn't force myself to chew anything. I didn't even want to swallow. They attached me to a morphine pump called a PC. Whenever the pain was really bad, I pushed a button to give myself a shot. I had to have pain medication constantly. At first, I tried to resist taking more painkillers, but the doctor rebuked me for that. He said that my body was tensing from the pain, and that retarded my healing. At night, they gave me additional medication to try to make me sleep. I write try because the additional medication didn't work. Nothing they did put me to sleep, not sleeping pills, pain shots, or additional morphine. I had no way to get comfortable or even to feel relieved enough from pain to relax. I've tried to explain it by saying it this way. Imagine yourself lying in bed, and you've got rods through your arms, wires through your legs, and you're on your back. You can't turn over. In fact, just to move your shoulder a quarter of an inch is impossible unless you reach up and grab what looks like a trapeze bar that hangs above your bed. Even the exertion to move a fraction of an inch sends daggers of pain all through your body. You are completely immobile. Because I began to break out with bed sores on my back due to being in one position too long, the hospital finally provided a special waterbed that constantly moved. That did take care of the bed sores. The only time I ever left the room was when they wheeled me down to X-ray, which was always an adventure. Because of all the metal parts and equipment on me, they had trouble figuring out how to X-ray me. Three or four men wore lead suits in the X-ray room and held the lenses and plates behind my steel-encased limbs because no machine was designed to X-ray those types of things. That also meant that some days I spent 2 or 3 hours in X-ray while the technicians tried to figure out how to take a picture so the doctors could see whether the bones were knitting. They had no precedent for a case such as mine. When someone came to wheel me to X-ray, he'd always say, "We're taking a trip down the hall." That was all they had to say because I knew what they meant. To distract myself as the gurney cruised down the long hallways, I played a game of connect the dots with the ceiling tiles. I started that the day I came back from the first surgery. I was probably hallucinating, but I remember the ICU unit was brand new, and I was the only patient. When they brought me in, I was moaning and couldn't stop. Then I saw the ceiling tiles. As I stared at them, it seemed as if they were running together and forming some kind of pattern that I couldn't figure out. In my mind, I began making pictures and designs out of them. As I did that, I'd also think, I'm going completely crazy. But I did it anyway. Eventually, connecting the dots became a form of distraction, allowing me to focus, if only momentarily, on something other than my pain. The worst daily torment took place when a nurse cleaned the pinholes where the wires went into my skin. All the nurses that treated me on the orthopedic floor, the 21st floor of St. Luke's Hospital, had to be taught how to clean those pinholes. Because they didn't want the skin to adhere to the wire, they had to keep breaking the skin when it attached itself, as it did occasionally. Then the nurse forced hydrogen peroxide down each pinhole to prevent infection. I could think of nothing worse to endure, and it happened every day. That wasn't all. 4 times a day, every 6 hours, they'd take an Allen wrench and turn the screws on the device. The idea was that this would stretch the ends of the bone inside the leg and eventually cause the growing bone to replace the missing bone. The turn hurt beyond description, even though each turn was very slight, less than 0.5 millimeter. It didn't matter whether it was day or night, every 6 hours, someone came into my room to turn the screws. As a pastor, I had visited many hospital rooms, including trips to the ICU. I had seen agony on many faces, and I had frequently winced in sympathy. Even so, I couldn't imagine anything on a day-to-day basis that could be more painful. Perhaps the worst part of it for me was that I never slept. For 11.5 months, I never went to sleep. I just passed out. Even with megadoses of morphine, I was never pain-free. When they decided it was time for me to go to sleep, a nurse injected me with 3 or 4 shots of either morphine or another sleeping medicine. I'd lie in bed, and no matter how much I told myself to relax, I couldn't. I fought the pain, and then, apparently, I passed out. My next conscious moment would be an awareness of intense pain. I felt nothing else in between. Eventually, family members and even hospital personnel left me alone because they knew I didn't have a functioning body clock. I had no sense of time, and I couldn't relax because I was under such tension. If I made the slightest effort to move, a wire embedded in my flesh would tear my skin at the point of entry. I could move, but the wires didn't. With even the tiniest movement, excruciating pain slashed through my entire body. After a while, I learned to live with the situation, but I never got used to it. The first person I met, we never saw each other in person, for whom the Elizaroff frame was used for its original purpose, was Christy. The Elizaroff procedure was created to lengthen bones for people born with congenital birth defects. However, the device could not be attached until the bones had stopped growing. Especially during adolescence, bones grow at a very rapid pace, so doctors must carefully choose the right time for the procedure. Christy, a teenage girl, was in the room next to mine. She had been born with one leg shorter than the other. Once her bones had matured, she had chosen surgery to attach the Elizaroff frame to have her bones lengthened so that both legs would be of normal size. Because Christy's surgery was elective, she had some idea about the pain and length of recovery she would have to go through. For months, She had gone through extensive counseling, and her family knew how to take care of the wounds. They also knew approximately how long it would take and the commitment they had to make to care for her. The difference between Christy and me was that she knew what she was getting into, at least to the extent that anyone can. I woke up with a device already attached. In my depressed state, that made me feel even worse. Even though I knew they had to put the Elizaroff frame on me to save my leg, I could only see it as the major source of my agony. Another problem arose, although a minor one. Even though we had different doctors, the same staff people came into Christy's room and mine to turn the screws. Sometimes the wrenches got misplaced and the attendants couldn't find them in my room, so they'd rush over to Christy's for hers, or they'd come and borrow mine. Fortunately for both of us, our fixators were interchangeable, and someone could borrow wrenches from one room to adjust screws in the other. That's how I first learned about Christy, the borrowing of wrenches. We never saw each other face to face, but we did see each other's doctors, and somehow that, plus our common problem, created a bond between us. Christy and I shared something else, pain. Many times I heard her crying. I don't mean weeping, but a cry or a scream, and sometimes just a low moan. She probably heard similar sounds from my room as well. I wasn't as likely to cry because that's not my nature. One of the nurses suggested it might be better if I just let go and scream. Even though she may have been right, I never did. At least not consciously. When I was in control of my faculties, I never cried out. I heard others scream from their pain, and their cries disturbed me greatly. Also, I had learned to keep my hurts and emotions to myself. I believed at the time that moans, wails, and screams did no good. The only times I screamed, I was either unconscious or heavily medicated. I learned about those outbursts because other people told me. Although Christy and I never met during the 12 weeks we lived next door to each other, we corresponded by sending letters back and forth, and the nurses willingly acted as our mail carriers. I tried to encourage Christy. She told me her story and was very sympathetic to my accident. She was also a believer. We corresponded on that level as well. In some of my worst moments of self-pity, however, I would think that when all the pain was over, Christy would be a normal young woman. I would never be normal again. She could play and run and do everything a normal teen did. Even then, I knew I would never run again. I had many, many times of self-pity, reminding myself that she chose her pain while I had no warning and no option. She knew in advance what she was getting into. I had no idea. She was doing something that positively impacted the rest of her life. I was doing something just to save my life. Yes, self-pity filled my mind many, many days. Always, however, I came back to one thing. God had chosen to keep me alive. Even in my worst moments of depression and self-pity, I never forgot that. Christy and I shared similar pain. We also shared a faith that reminded us that our loving God was with us in the most terrible moments of suffering. Just having her in the next room comforted me, because I'd think, I'm not the only one. Somebody else understands how I feel. That's when I began to think of being part of an exclusive fraternity. In the year since my release, I've met other members of this reluctant and small fellowship. Because I knew what it felt like to suffer, I could understand their pain, just as Christy had felt mine, and I had understood hers. More than enduring, eventually I was able to do something doctors said I would never be able to do. I learned to walk again. I can stand on my own feet, put one foot in front of the other, and move. They had warned me that because of the broken knee in my right leg and the loss of the femur in my left, even with a replaced and stretched bone in place, I would not walk again. And if I did, I would be wearing heavy braces. More than once, I came close to losing my left leg, but somehow God took me through each crisis. Therapy began on my arm about 4 weeks after the initial operation, and on my legs 2 weeks after that. About the same time, they put me in what I referred to as a Frankenstein bed. They strapped me to a large board and turned the bed so that my feet were on the floor and I was in a standing position, although still strapped to the bed. Two physical therapists placed a large belt around my waist and walked on either side of me. My legs had atrophied and grown extremely weak, so they helped me take my first step. It took me days to learn to stand again so that I could put my weight on my own legs. My equilibrium had changed because I had grown used to a horizontal position. I became incredibly nauseous each time they raised me into a vertical position. Days passed before I was used to that position enough to take my first step. I didn't really learn to walk until after the hospital discharged me. A physical therapist came in every other day to help me. 6 months would pass before I learned to walk on my own more than a few steps. My doctor removed the Elizaroff device 11 and a half months after the accident. After that, I could use a walker and eventually a cane. I didn't walk without leg braces and a cane for a year and a half after the accident. My accident occurred in January 1989. They removed the external metalwork from my arm fixator in May, but they put internal metal plates down both of the bones of the forearm. Those metal plates stayed there for several more months. In late November, they removed the fixator from my leg, but that wasn't the end of it. After that, I remained in a cast for a long time, and they inserted a plate in my leg, which stayed there for 9 years. I was content to leave it there, but they said they had to take it out. My doctor explained that as I aged, the bones, relying on the plate for strength, would become brittle. As I learned, our bones become and remain strong only as a result of tension and use. During those years with the fixator and the subsequent metal plates, whenever I had to fly, I set off metal detectors from Ohio to California. Rather than go through the customary walk-through detector, I would say to the security people, "I have more stainless steel in me than your silverware drawer at home." They would wand me and smile, "You sure do." My children took pride in referring to me as Robo-Preacher, after the title character in the movie RoboCop. After a horrible incident, doctors used high technology and metal plates to restore the policeman so he could fight crime. Regardless of how barbaric all these rods and wires and plates might have seemed, they worked. People gasped when they saw them embedded in my flesh. Those same people are now awed at my mobility. But under this thin veneer of normalcy, I'm still a work in progress, always adjusting. Chapter 9. Endless Adjustments. Proverbs 17:17. A friend is always loyal, and a brother is born to help in time of need. Proverbs 17:17. It's amazing how differently people responded after the accident. Several friends and members of South Park Church saw me during those first 5 days after my accident. Many of those same people saw me after the all-night prayer vigil that David Gentiles instigated. As they watched each tiny step of my recovery, they rejoiced. I saw everything in my recovery happening so slowly that acute depression continually gripped me. After the ICU, I stayed in the hospital 105 days the first time. I suppose depression would strike anyone who has been confined that long. During the months of my recovery, the church worked hard to make me feel useful. They brought vanloads of kids to the hospital to see me. Sometimes committees met in my hospital room, as if I could make any decisions. They knew I couldn't say or do much, but it was their way to affirm and encourage me. They did everything they could to make me feel worthwhile and useful. Much of that time, however, I was depressed and filled with self-pity. I yearned to go back to heaven. Beyond the depression, I had another problem. I didn't want anybody to do anything for me. That's my nature. One day, J.B. Perkins, a retired minister, came to visit me. He had served as pastor of several South Texas churches before his retirement and had become a powerful father figure in the ministry for me. South Park hired him as the interim while I was incapacitated. Jay visited me faithfully. That meant he had to drive more than 40 miles each way. He came often to see me, sometimes two or three times a week. I wasn't fit company, but I smiled each time anyway. I'd lie in bed and feel sorry for myself. He'd speak kindly, always trying to find words to encourage me, but nothing he said helped, although that wasn't his fault. No one could help me. Not only was I miserable, but as I later learned, I made everyone else miserable. My visitors tried to help me, and many wanted to do whatever they could for me. "Can I get you a magazine?" someone would ask. "Would you like a milkshake? There's a McDonald's in the lobby, or I could get you a hamburger, or would you like for me to read the Bible to you, or maybe some other book? Are there any errands I could run for you?" My answer was always the same. "No, thanks." I don't think I was mean, but I wasn't friendly or cooperative, although I wasn't aware of how negatively I treated everybody. I didn't want to see anyone. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I wanted my pain and disfigurement to go away. If I had to stay on earth, then I wanted to get well and get back to living my life again. Because Jay visited often, he noticed how detached I was from friends and family. One day he was sitting beside me when one of the South Park deacons came for a visit. After 10 minutes, the man got up and said, "I just wanted to come by and check on you." Then he asked the inevitable question, "Is there anything I can get for you before I leave?" "Thank you. No, I appreciate it, but..." "Well, can I get you something to eat? Can I go downstairs and..." "No, really, thanks for coming." He said goodbye and left. Jay sat silently and stared out the window for a few minutes after the deacon left. Finally, he walked over to the bed and got close to my face and said, "You really need to get your act together." "Sir?" I said, like anyone would say respectfully to an 80-year-old preacher. "You need to get your act together," he repeated. "You're just not doing a very good job." "I don't understand what..." "Besides that," he said, and moved closer so that I couldn't look away, "besides that, you're a raging hypocrite." "I don't know what you're talking about. These people care about you so much, and you just can't imagine how deeply they love you." "I know they love me." "Really? Well, you're not doing a very good job of letting them know you're aware. You're not treating them right. They can't heal you. If they could heal you, they would do it. If they could change places with you, many of them would. If you ask them to do anything, anything, they would do it without hesitating. I know. But you won't let them do anything for you. I don't want them to do anything. Without holding anything back, I said as loudly as I could, the truth is, I don't even want them to be here. I just assume they didn't come. I know it's inconvenient. They must have better things to do. I know that. Why would I want anybody to come and see me like this? It's just awful. I'm pathetic. It's not your call. I stared back, shocked at his words. You spent the better part of your life trying to minister to other people, to meet their needs, to help them during times of difficulty and tragedy, and I tried to, and now you're doing a terrible job of letting these people do the same thing for you. I'll never forget the next sentence. Don, it's the only thing they have to offer you, and you're taking that gift away from them. Not ready to surrender, I protested and tried to explain. He interrupted me again. You're not letting them minister to you. It's what they want to do. Why can't you understand that? I really didn't get the impact of his words, but I said, I appreciate them, and I know they want to help, and I think that's very fine and everything, but nothing. You're cheating them out of an opportunity to express their love to you. His words shocked me. In my thinking, I was trying to be selfless and not impose on them or cause them any trouble. Just then, his words penetrated my consciousness. In reality, I was being selfish. There was also an element of pride there, which I couldn't admit then. I knew how to give generously to others, but pride wouldn't let me receive others' generosity. Jay didn't let up on me. After all, I was a completely captive audience. He stared at me until he forced me to see how badly I distanced myself from everyone. Even then, I found additional excuses, but Jay wore me down. I want you to let them help you. Do you hear me? You will allow them to help you. I can't. I just can't let them. Okay, Don. Then if you don't do it for yourself, do this for me, he said. He knew I'd do anything for him, so I nodded. The next time anyone comes in here and offers to do something, anything, no matter what it is, I want you to say yes. You probably can't do that with everyone, but you can start with just one or two people. Let a few of the people express their love by helping you. Promise me you'll do that. I'm not sure I can. Yes, you can. I'll try. But that's just not me. Then make it you. His gaze bored into me. Do it. I'm amazed now as I think of Jay's patience with me. His voice softened and he said, just try it for me, would you? You have to get better at this. Right now you're not doing very well. And this is one of the lessons that God wants you to learn. You're going to be hurting a long time. It'll feel longer if you keep on refusing help. Okay, I said, unable to resist any longer. I promised. I didn't think he would leave until I did. My first reaction had been irritation, maybe even anger. I thought he had stepped over the line, but I didn't say that. After he left, I thought about all the things he had said. Once I overcame my anger, my pride, and my selfishness, I realized he had spoken the truth. Truth I needed to hear. 2 days passed, and I still couldn't do what he asked. On the third day, a church member popped into my room and greeted me, and spent about 5 minutes with me before he got up to leave. "I just wanted to come by and check on you and see how you were doing," he said. "You're looking good." I smiled. I looked terrible, but I didn't argue with him. He stood up to leave. "Is there anything I can do for you before I go?" I had my mouth poised to say the words, "No, thank you." And an image of Jay popped into my mind. "Well, I wish I had a magazine to read." "You do?" He had the biggest grin on his face. "Really? I think so. I haven't read one in a while. I'll be right back." Before I could tell him what kind, he dashed out the door so fast it was like a human blur. He had to go down 21 floors, but it seemed like as if he were gone less than a minute. When he returned, he had an armload of magazines. He was still grinning as he showed me the covers of all of them. I thanked him. "I'll read them a little later," I said. He put them on the table and smiled. "Is there anything else?" "No, no, no. That's all I need. Thank you." Once I had opened the door and allowed someone to do something kind for me, I realized it wasn't so hard after all. After he left, I began skimming through the magazines. I wasn't really reading because I kept thinking about what had happened. Jay was right. I had cheated them out of the opportunity to express their love and concern. About 40 minutes later, a woman from the singles group came to see me. We went through the regular ritual of chatting. "How are you doing?" "Fine." "Well, can I get you anything?" "No, no, I..." Again, Jay's words popped into my head. "Well, maybe a strawberry milkshake." "Strawberry milkshake? I'd love to get one for you." I don't think I had ever seen her smile so beautifully before. "Anything else? Some fries, maybe?" "No." She dashed out the door and came back with a strawberry milkshake. "Oh, Pastor, I hope you enjoy this." "I will," I said. "As a matter of fact, I love strawberry milkshakes." Later, I imagined members of the congregation standing outside my door, comparing notes. "He asked me to get him a strawberry milkshake." "Yes, and he let me run an errand for him." Just then, I realized how badly I had missed the whole idea. I had failed them and myself. In trying to be strong for them, I had cheated them out of opportunities to strengthen me. Guilt overwhelmed me because I could, at last, see their gifts to me. The shame flowed all over me, and I began to cry. This is their ministry, I thought, and I've been spoiling it. I felt such intense shame over not letting them help. When I finally did open up, I witnessed a drastic change in their facial expressions and their movements. They loved it. All they wanted was a chance to do something, and I was finally giving that to them. You need to get your act together. For the next several hours, those words of loving rebuke from Jay wouldn't go away. Tears flowed. I have no idea how much time passed, but it seemed like hours before I finally realized God had forgiven me. I had learned a lesson. In spite of my condition, not many people could have pulled off what Jay did. That experience changed my attitude. Even now, years later, I still fight with allowing others to help. But at least the door is now ajar instead of locked shut. Sometimes when I'm emotionally low or physically down, I tend to brush people off or assert that I don't need anything. Yet when I can open up and allow others to exercise their gifts and help me, it makes such a difference. Their faces light up as if they're asking, "Will you really let me do that for you?" I had seen my refusal as not wanting to impose. They saw my change as giving them an opportunity to help. I'm eternally grateful for that lesson of allowing people to meet my needs. I'm also grateful because that lesson was learned in a hospital bed when I was helpless. Someone brought a plaque to me in the hospital. At first, I thought it was supposed to be some kind of joke because it contained the words of Psalm 46:10. "Be still and know I am God." Perhaps it was meant to console me. I'm not sure the person who gave it to me, and I don't remember who it was, realized that I couldn't do anything but be still. Yet the plaque contained the message I needed. It just took me a long time to understand. Weeks lapsed before I realized that part of what I needed was to be still inwardly and to trust that God knew what he was doing through all of this. Yes, it was a verse for me, even though it wasn't one I would have chosen. God forced me to be still. By nature, I'm not particularly introspective, but I became increasingly so. I had no choice. I could do little else other than feel sorry for myself. The longer I lay immobile, the more open I became to God's quietness and to inner silence. Eva found a beautiful version of that same verse engraved in gold and gave it to me as a gift. That plaque is now in my church office. I see it every time I look up from my desk. Day after day, I lay in bed, unable to move. I lay on my back a total of 13 months before I could turn on my side. Just that simple action made it one of the best days of recovery. "Oh, I had forgotten how good this feels," I said aloud. During that long recovery, I learned a lot about myself, about my attitude and my nature. I didn't like many things I saw in Don Piper. In the midst of that inactivity, however, the depression persisted. I began to wonder if that depression would ever go away. Then God provided another miracle. Chapter 10, More Miracles. Psalm 34, 1 through 4. I will praise the Lord at all times. I will constantly speak his praises. I will boast only in the Lord. Let all who are discouraged take heart. Come, let us tell of the Lord's greatness. Let us exalt his name together. I prayed to the Lord, and he answered me, freeing me from all my fears. Psalm 34, 1 through 4. Sometimes the depression became so bad I didn't think I could breathe. It carried me back to the days in the ICU when I received breathing treatments because my lungs had collapsed. Except now, my lungs weren't collapsed. Only my spirit. Few things sap the human spirit like the lack of hope. For weeks and months, no one could tell me when or even if I would ever be normal again. As a result, I went into a full-scale depression. As my horribly mangled body mended, I needed spiritual mending as well. I began to think of it this way. The Greek word for spirit is pneuma. The word can also mean wind or breath. That Greek word is the root of what we call pneumonia. Just as it was necessary to reinflate my lungs to overcome pneumonia, I needed the breath of God to help me overcome the depression of my spirit. I don't know when I became aware of that depression. In the first few weeks of my recovery, I was in such constant physical pain, I couldn't hold any thoughts in my mind for more than a second or two. I also battled a lot of anger during those first weeks. I wasn't angry with God, though I often wondered why God had sent me back to earth and why I had to go through such intense physical agony. But even being in pain was not the issue for me. From my first days in the hospital, pain had always been present. Like many others, I learned to live with that reality. My struggle is that I had experienced the glory and majesty of heaven, only to return to earth. In my weaker moments, I didn't understand why God would return me to earth in such awful condition. Many live in greater pain, but few, if any, have experienced heaven. Instead, my anger focused primarily on the medical staff. I suppose it was because they were there all the time. Deep inside, I seethed with an inner rage, perhaps at myself as much as the medical staff. Why wasn't I recuperating faster? I blamed them for the slowness of my recovery. In my rational moments, I knew they did the best they could. Despite my antagonism and irritation, which I'm sure they sensed, they stayed right with me and constantly encouraged me. I didn't want encouragement. I wanted results. I wanted to be healthy again. Why couldn't my life be the way it used to be? I wanted to walk by myself, and I didn't want to depend on others all the time. The medical staff wouldn't give me any definite answers, and that sent fresh waves of rage through my system. In retrospect, I'm sure they told me what they could, but I was anything but a typical case. No one knew my prognosis. In fact, for several weeks, they weren't even sure if I would live, let alone make a significant recovery. I became paranoid. I knew I wasn't rational, even when I complained and demanded more attention or additional medication to alleviate the pain. Nothing suited me. The pace was too slow. They made me wait too long before responding to my bell. No one wanted to answer questions. "How long will I have to wear this Elizaroff frame?" I asked almost every medical person who came into my room. "I don't know," was the most common answer. "But I want to know something," I finally said. "A long time, a very long time," was the only answer a nurse or doctor would give me. A couple of times, I just had to have an answer, so I kept pressing the doctor. "Weeks, months," he said. "We can't tell you because we don't know. If I knew, I'd tell you." Common sense said that they were doing their best, but in those days, I didn't have much common sense. Part of it was the pain. Perhaps the mammoth doses of medication affected me as well, but I wasn't a good patient. Instead of being satisfied, I kept asking myself, why won't they tell me? What do they know that they're hiding? There are things they're not telling me, and I have a right to know what's going on. During many sleepless nights, I would lie in bed, convinced that the nurses conspired against me. It never occurred to me to wonder why they would want to do that. "Then why don't they tell me anything?" I'd rail as I lay there. "What can they possibly do that will hurt me more than this?" The answer was nothing. I endured additional pain that resulted not from the accident itself, but from the process of healing. For instance, when they harvested bones out of my right hip and put them in my left arm, they made an incision 6 inches long and closed it up with metal staples. When the day came for them to take out the staples, they pulled them out of my skin. As they pulled each one, I winced in pain and steeled myself so that I wouldn't scream at the top of my lungs. I couldn't remember hurting that excruciatingly. I had, of course, but I had forgotten how much torture my body could take. The poor nurse who was extracting the staples stopped after each one. Sadness filled her eyes, and I knew she sensed how deeply the procedure hurt me. She was a large woman, and always treated me as gently as she could. "I'm sorry, Reverend," she said softly. "I know," I mumbled. "You can't help it." Momentarily, I lapsed into my pastoral role of trying to console her. I didn't want her to feel bad for the torture I felt. "Reverend, why don't you just haul off and yell?" "It wouldn't do any good." "If it was me, I'd be yelling." "Yeah, I bet you would," I offered a faint sense of humor, "and you'd wake up every patient in the hospital." I just never could yell voluntarily. Maybe it was a fear of losing control. Perhaps I feared that if I did scream, she and others would consider me as weak. I'm not sure of the reasons, even now. I know only that I couldn't scream like others on my floor. From several other rooms, every day I heard patients scream out in agony. I just couldn't let go like that. Instead, I'd hold my breath and sometimes break out in a cold sweat, but I wouldn't scream purposely. Though I know I wasn't the easiest of patients in demeanor or medical requirements, the nurses of the orthopedic floor treated me with kindness and much compassion. I learned to care a great deal for them and admire their dedication. I guess they must have seen something in me as well. I know the nursing staff often bent the rules when well-wishers showed up to see me, no matter what time of day or night they came. But the sweetest moment came when I was discharged from my 105-day stay at St. Luke's. Apparently, arrangements were made with nursing staffs of other hospital floors to cover for them as the nurses from my floor all accompanied me down the elevator and to my waiting ambulance on the day of my discharge. Being surrounded by nurses that fed me, medicated me, bathed me, and did only the Lord knows what else, made my going home that day so wonderful. It was as if they were saying, "We've done our best. Now you've got to get better and come back and see us." I can only imagine how different I must have seemed to them that going home day from the day I had arrived wavering between life and death. In spite of my stubborn resistance to showing emotions, before I left St. Luke's, the months of intense pain finally crumbled my resolve. I broke down and cried. I felt worthless, beaten down, and useless. I was convinced I would never get any better. God, God, why is it like this? Why am I going through this constant pain that never seems to get any better? Again, I prayed for God to take me. I didn't want to live any longer. I wanted to go back home, and now for me, home meant heaven. I prayed that way for days, and usually I'd fall asleep from exhaustion. When I'd awaken, a cloak of hopelessness would spread over me again. Nothing helped. Just before the accident, I had ordered several cassette tapes of popular Christian songs originally recorded during the 1960s and 70s by people like the Imperials and David Meese. Eva had brought them to the hospital along with a tape player, but I had no interest in listening to them. Instead, I watched TV. I once told a friend, "I've watched every Brady Bunch episode at least 8 times, and I know all the dialogue by heart." One morning between 3 and 5 o'clock, I couldn't bear to watch another TV rerun, so I decided to play the cassettes. A nurse came in and helped me set up the first cassette to play. The first song had been recorded by the Imperials, and it was called "Praise the Lord." The lyrics suggest that when we're up against a struggle and we think we can't go on, we need to praise God. As preposterous as that prospect seemed at 3 o'clock in the morning in a hospital bed, I continued to listen for any help to bring me out of my deep heartache. There was a phrase in the next verse about the chains that seem to bind us falling away when we turn ourselves over to praise. The whole song centered on praising God in spite of our circumstances. The instant the Imperials sang the second chorus about the chains, I looked down at my chains, pounds of stainless steel encasing my arm and leg. Before the accident, I'm sure I'd heard and sung that song hundreds of times. I had even played it myself. Just then, those words became a message from God, a direct hit from on high. Before they had finished singing the song, I lay there and heard my own voice say, "Praise the Lord." No sooner had that song ended than David Meese sang, "We are the reason." His words reminded me that we are the reason Jesus Christ wept, suffered, and died on the cross. Meese sang about how he finally found the real purpose in living was in giving every part of his life to Christ. That wasn't a new song to me.